This poem is the second of three. They are long and intended to flow one from another, but each to make sense on its own. They have been written with an eye or ear to being read aloud, briskly. Sir Percy Hobart, Part 2. Hobo, the man of design and fabric. I approach Hobart as a spider might. I have him wrapped in the centre of my web. Let's say an honoured victim, snared, cocooned, but also preserved in wound-up memory. I descend a single strand to ogle the veil in which my prey is caught as slanting light dances on the dew. I am stitching him up, actually, in embroidery. But not mummified, I hope. I would bring him to life for you if I could. You'll see, I hope, if you follow this erratic track. I'll begin in Oxford and tangentially. I am spider crossed with crab. In the Ashmolean, in Jacobean needlework, done beside crackling firesides and within tree-shaded courtyards, which were for king or parliament, cavalier or roundhead, old or new religion. Early modern sort of catches their times. The works which the years have dimmed and dusted a little are glowing still, homely and homilistic, but propaganda too. I lent in a stranger to this work and my pleasure in it, but acquainting myself. The threads are heavy, some even metallic, gold strands still warm the inglenook flames. And some are so bulky in themselves or bulked up, they cast shadows, sculpted knots alongside beads, sheltering dust. You'll ask, where's Hobart in this meandering tale? And I reply, hold up, hang on, if you will, we'll get there. The world they were made in, these needled histories, and the praises they sing, the dreads they warn of, were tougher than we can imagine or could perhaps manage. These small panels, glorifying dynasties and Old Testament stories, say Esther and Ahasuerus and Hellenic myths, are women's work, not weak but patient, making household gods, embellishing and civilizing the domestic scene by bringing in tales of sacrifice and revenge. For years and years I had not seen the point in tapestries and embroidery, and gave no thought to needlework. Well, Chanel and Valentino, and now this needlepoint, put paid to that, and led the way to Hobart too. And now my eye tuned, its inner TV turned off, its cinema projector dimmed, its digitized pixelations returned to fingerwork. I see weaves and knots everywhere, in rope or chain or silk, in boudoir or armoury. I know, crack on, North, you have all day, you do, but readers can get fidgety. The week after Oxford, in our slowish progress, not quite royal, yet luxurious too, tracing the valley of the Thames and the Chilterns, by chance in Nuffield Place, where arts and crafts is hijacked by bright modernism, just by the fence of the holding camp for aliens, as it was that 70-odd years ago and is so again, there was Lady Nuffield's coronation robe made to honour Edward VIII, a golfing chum. It was run up for her by Elliston and Cavell. It's Debenhams now, where, as Lizzie Anstey, she had once worked with needle and thread. And now other women did her ermine piecework round the corner from Tradescant's shrine. And in my spider mind, I note that Sir Percy Hobart, maybe in 1946, finally retired and fearing final idleness, worked for old Nuffield's military division. They liked each other's ways, both believing that the man who had made weird tanks do wonderful work, that such a man might head off demands to produce the crazy curiosities, as the men who'd worked on Hobart's funnies called machines they feared the men from the ministry wanted. Perhaps one day, in that sunny palace, happily suburban, fringed by fields and wire mesh, her ladyship looked up from her needlework, probably some trite piece She was at it still for uninspired domestic use, a maid's uniform, a sampler's platitude, and wondered at this peculiar hero her husband had brought home. She might have thought, as Hobart did himself, that he was really quite grand, sort of primordially the knight, chivalric and noble, if maybe a mite crabby at times, and with a habit of command. Hobart, I remember, had told young officers the trick to army success was just the right amount of insubordination, but he had often overdone it himself, not quite from knowing better, but from a leaping heart, making his mind and lips impetuous. I imagine her imagining that Hobart was not knighted for merchanting and manufacture as her husband and the likes of her had been, but by the older currency of conquest, land and history, by marriage and muscle and smarts, by birth in short. And Hobart was grand, but in the grandest way, in fancy and by longing. In some youthful time, in some library perhaps, marooned in dreaming, he had connected to the smartest Hobarts of all, though it's clever more than chic that they seem to have been. The first Hobarts, they of Norfolk's Blickling Hall, were great in law, land and politics, stoutly Cromwellian, and give us a line to John Hampden too. And these allegiances suit our hero, his sternness and righteousness stiffening his dash with just a whiff of self-righteousness in a moral, somehow rebellious cause. But there is fantasy in Blickling Hall. Right from the start, the Hobarts were dreamers. Sir Henry Hobart, born 1560, parliamentarian and Calvinist, buying himself great bits of Norfolk and Blickling's antique greatness too, trumpeted its heraldic glamour as though a purchase allowed an inheritance as he built over the ruins of the house's earlier glory as a Boleyn bastion where Tudors had boasted argent, a chevron jewels between three bulls' heads, cooped sable. Those new Hobarts put the bull everywhere, not just on entry arches announcing the house, but on their coat of arms announcing their claims, borrowing a better past. And now we see our Percy Cleghorn Stanley Hobart, born 1885, in a middling status in England's Ireland, climb a heady ladder, spirited out of Blickling's borrowed splendours, but probably earned and owed to his own success in middle age, in the midst of a huge war, at once democratic and yet seeking and making men of destiny. Hobart borrows old nostalgias and plants them, pins and stitches them, ready for battle dress, and stencils them on his armoured divisions called the Bulls, just as men and steeds have distinguished themselves for millennia. Stubbornly medieval, perennially symbolic, the heraldic bull insists that the best men of every age are wont to make themselves up, proving self-invention's great pedigree. These were the dreams of a haunted boy, one like Robert Louis Stevenson, perhaps. Anyone, one whose bedroom wallpaper of dragons and maidens were ever after his tokens of valour and force, capable of good or bad, ripe for slaying and to be slayed for honour. And now these threads must come together, and they do by bull, book, and probably not candle. Under some low wattage bulb, Percy, always known as Patrick to his family, or Hobo to the wider world, in 1941, in a happy moment, amidst frantic lucubrations, drew a bull on a sketch pad, as he might have done as a child, or as a cadet in the shop in Woolwich, where every engineer officer of his generation was taught to draw. The very paper may have reminded him of the cavalry pad strapped to his forearm when he was mounted in his early days and needed to portray some tribal domain in the great game, as though a Lear or Spencer gone even further east. His artist's eye loved the scope he found in those hinterlands of Tartary and the Stans, beyond all order, where life strained the imagination fit for the eye of G.F. Watts, daubed in Guildford, and treasured on Sunday afternoons by weekend bohemians awakened by chaos by the Thames in the Tate. Anyway, in 1941, he's 56, and a mere major general. His coevals were slipping well ahead of him by now, and he has taken command of the 11th Armoured Division. It is to be remade in his image, as fashioned in his mind over years, fallowed in his banishment, refined in his underemployment. But even at this moment, when subordinates look to him for detailed conceptions of every aspect of this great apparatus they have been set to make and mobilise, he yet sees something else which no one is asking for. Poised amidst his soldiering, there is an illustrator's pencil, itching to create, longing, I risk saying, to banish all pettiness and make loveliness express something bolder, clearer, more invigorating than a well-crafted order. Hobart drew an insignia, a flash for his division, for their upper arms and the flanks of their vehicles. It wasn't quite invented, no heraldry is, but rift by a sort of genius, a bull profiled in full body. This work of Hobart's has an ad man's manipulative flair, an embroiderer's empathy, a herald's clarion youthfulness. A bull sable, passant, regardant, it is Hobart's homage to Boleyn and the Cromwellian Hobart, and to the Ironside cavalry, and it is balm to his soul. His bull stamped Hobart's imprimatur with every heavy, impatient step. Speaking of heft-powered horns, red-tipped, blooded, the beast was stalwart at rest and furious when roused, snorting through crimson-veined nostril flares, emboldening the men who had one patched or painted declaratively. Hobart sought to mark his men and their machines and make them his, even as he gives them an identity so they may know each other and be a band of men. But it is not for Hobart alone to say his insignia will pass muster. Such things are judged by the Royal School of Needlework, and they stitch a fabric sample from his sketch and send it back. "Oh, balls," cries Hobart when he sees their work, or something like that. I made that up, that little outburst. He demands they resubmit. He demands the bull be not merely embroidered, as manly in a general way, but entire, as the vets say, intact, fully furnished, well hung, if you like, even as a sort of tapestry. A man at his most feminine, one might say, produces an emblem utterly masculine. And so it is when Hobart's long left that command, the bull's progenitor and the division's, indeed, nearly 3 years later, in 44 and 45, and the image is on shoulder and bodywork when they go into action, from Normandy to Flanders in the last months of this oil-driven war, as Germany's empire was rolled back to Berlin and oblivion. Wind back, though. It's 1941. Hobart's work on the 11th is finished. Since they are ready for battle, old Hobo must move on. There's a War Office faction would have ditched him then, altogether, at last, on grounds of age and convalescence, as it happens, and grudges old and new. But Churchill declares himself again a fan of nearly everything they dislike in Hobart, and he is allowed what he would make his great moment. He creates the 79th Armoured Division, what he calls the best of the Black Bulls. and straightway, as though to stress he's at the same work, continuing it but advancing it, he draws another divisional flash, and this time it is the bull's head alone. And he wonders then, has he been overdramatic, made too much of a point, drawing attention to himself as much as the cause? He asks a friend, is this too symbolical? These were khaki times, bleak and drab by modern reckoning, being in monochrome, and lived by people mostly dead to us, who knew them as grandfathers, traduced now as uptight or anyway benighted. But doesn't his very diction speak of a freer time when the upper classes or those who aspired to them were freely camp? I didn't tell you yet the thing which Hobart did which would make the tissue sequence in the movie someone might make. The first biographer of his 79th, Hobo's ADC, and then his GSO2, his right-hand man, so to say, the squire to his knight, was rich and Etonian and probably quite relaxed. Anyway, crotchety General Hobart had this John Borthwick, his smart young comrade and confederate, as I dare propose him, to stay in the beloved family time and place, and neither had a valet nor the house a butler. Some village skivvy might have figured, maybe a woman who does, who knows. There might have been a daily, soon to come, but not yet arrived. Anyway, Borthwick records, a little awed, a domestic weekend scene. I imagine a floral pinny, quite faded, preserving scruffy cricket whites, held up by a scrawny tie, and a threadbare carpet runs a strip down the boards of the upstairs corridor just after dawn. Hobart brings his guest his early morning tea and takes away his shoes to shine them. And so Hobart proved himself a man who loved spit and polish, and perhaps the imitation of Christ or a commanding officer's noblesse oblige. Hobart's machines match him. He is the master of peculiarities. His tanks are coracle confections in canvas and steel, and dragon conceits with tails of bouncing petrol bowsers to breathe fire, and heaped up like peasant donkeys with fascines of innocent half-grown coppice wood to bridge ditches. Hobart is congruently the king of the incongruous, laying out this rattling, greasy tool-bag of dangerous delights, scattered at the feet of younger commanders who can bid them go forth and reassemble, transformed, to avenge Dunkirk in a war in which veterans of 25 had too little time to pity the arriving tyros of 18 or the older men newly come to the field from the beginnings of rose gardens, steady in the marriage bed, but unsure how military life will treat them. England would not be England if all she bred were Churchills, for whom all life is a battlefield, or a field of the cloth of gold, or the ball before Waterloo, rather than a chamber of commerce, or a Bazalgette fixing the drains, or all the chamberlains being municipal. And even generals come in every form, many quite modest, even in their pomp. I find few I don't admire, even if it's a cheek for me to say so. But Hobart is preeminent, as I prick out my virtues, those of others, as might a gardener choose between seedlings fit for a summer's marquise. I never read of him saying a stupid thing without regretting it, and saying so, or making up for it. Even his cruelty is only ever small, and purposed to make men junior to him a bit safer or more effective. He loves women and grows in his wondering appreciation of them and their being both themselves and the other half of their men. And he ponders the odd luminous quagmire that is charm, which he has largely disadmired from afar. By the end of his career, his triumphs are great, and he knows he is loved, even though peace is always ungrateful. He knows the value of honour and violence, and of wiliness too. And he knows that he should not mourn that he has never directed the highest order of things. He has taught but not spearheaded strategy. And now, when he knows he has invented those indispensable divisions whose charges he never led himself, he is perhaps past regret. People all around him, above and below, knew Hobo pretty well, and he knew himself too. Hobart is a spirit, both within near reach and somehow sui generis. This is a soldier soul, buffeted as well as great, pushed around by history before our eyes, and as it careens about him, he writes good letters and orders and specifications and makes a story which lets us see so many dimensions of the warrior. After the war, this man who was loved by those who served under him and was so hard to manage almost slipped from view. And yet we do see him again, glimpsed in the Royal Hospital, Chelsea, where he commands the glamorous old warriors, and he is for once the youngest amongst his men. His apartment there suits him well. His grown-up children and their friends, the old Chelsea underworld of artists, the old tight street of Whistler and Sickert, and the new King's Road, raffish and waiting for Bacon, beatniks and the punks. That Bohemia is at hand, and some affluence too. These lap at the gates of the world of Wren and Wellington, his latest domain. He is busy here as well, perhaps too busy. He fixed the kitchen and brought in physiotherapy and an occupational therapist, and nobody minded much. But he saw further disgraces in the vaulted ceilings of the hospital's gleaming halls and fusty windows glamorized by the limp, peaceful banners, standards and flags of the enemies outflanked and outpounded by British armies. Many of these, as in churches and cathedrals everywhere, were honoured but neglected, and their condition offended officious Hobo. They'd been made threadbare by sunlight, and probably by every kind of smoke and city dust. The worst of them he has replaced, and orders the originals be destroyed. Perhaps he fears they have the moth, or perhaps he thinks they've had enough of shame. Perhaps he merely forgets to temper the shorn lamb to the gales of the new. Anyway, he was always brisk with a new broom, and sure of his ways. But he has met his match, and some of the old boys, long in the tooth, mature in the knowledge of officers' ways, take the discarded, wrecked flags and hide them in their own bits of privacy beyond inspection. Perhaps they cared, these old soldiers, for the plain but forgotten facts. They were men who'd followed the flag one way or another, and perhaps respected the particular item, the very thing, the actual cloth, which had seen battle and watched men die and hung over funerals. Perhaps their own dim ears thought the dim flags could still hear bugles and were entitled to live out their lives any way they liked. We are told the hospital liked the Hobo and admired him. But if he is fabulously active, his new charges could be really stubborn in their slower ways.